Mechai Viravedia talks with Sheila Setharaman about establishing the Population and Community Development Association in Thailand. The organization addresses health and poverty issues.
On Social Innovation Conversations.
Hi, I'm Chris Deigelmeyer, the Executive Director of the Center for Social Innovation.
And I'm Eric Nee, the Managing Editor of the Stanford Social Innovation Review.
Welcome to Social Innovation Conversations. Today, we're excited to introduce a new interview by Sheila Setharaman in our Design for Change series. Sheila Setharaman is a correspondent of the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental issues. She asked accomplished social entrepreneurs how they design and run their organizations for impact.
And now, here's our presentation from the Design for Change interview series.
Welcome to Design for Change, where we talk to entrepreneurs around the world who are creating sustainable models for social change. This is your host, Sheila Setharaman. We are pleased to have Mechai Viravedia on our show today. Known as one of the 20 most influential people in Asia, Mechai is chairman and founder of the Population and Community Development Association. PDA, as it's known in short, has come up with an innovative method to address numerous health issues affecting the people of Thailand, especially HIV and AIDS. His efforts have helped PDA attain worldwide status, including the 2007 Gates Award for Global Health. We are delighted you could be with us today. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, Sheila.
I've been reading a lot about your work, and one thing that I often read is you are known as the Condom King. So that is quite an interesting title. Can you start by actually telling us how you got that title?
That title was given to me by the newspapers back in 1973 when I said that if we want to be serious about family planning, then we have to get the shyness and embarrassment out of people seeing or talking about contraceptives. And certainly everything else didn't stir much attention, but the condom did. So I started giving out condoms, and there were people laughing and there were people embarrassed and so on, but I kept it up. And in the long run, a lot of people were much more at ease with it. And the newspaper said, well, as a sort of a punishment to me, really, at that time, said, let's now call the condom by his name. And so it stuck, and cartoonists started doing it, and disc jockeys. And in the end, the condom in Thailand became known as Mechai. So my name is now synonymous with the condom. And that's how it got there. So it's about 36 years now.
That's interesting, but you're actually wearing it as a badge of honor almost, because I know that your work over the years, it started with family planning, a very serious and important issue, and then it's moved on to so many other areas, rural development, providing job opportunities for women in need. So tell us a little bit about the work itself, the PDA, your organization. You began it about then, I guess, 1973-74. And it's a huge organization now. So help me understand how that happened.
We are now involved in about 8 areas of work. Basically, what the needs of the villagers are. They have several needs. And so we decided that we should be a sort of a 7-Eleven of development. So it's integrated in terms of service provision, in terms of working with them. We started off in population first because we had so many children per family. That is, in fact, 7 children per family. And horrendously high growth rate. So that was our first issue to tackle. And then the other very important issue was poverty. And so we said, we'll start the population first because it'll cost less. It's changing attitudes and behavior. Whereas poverty, you need a bit more resources. So we started with that. And in between doing the family planning and the poverty alleviation, AIDS came along. So we tackled that too. By using what we have been learning and what we had achieved in family planning to work with HIV AIDS. Now, to keep things short, we were able to get ordinary people the right to provide oral contraceptives to the people because we didn't have enough doctors, didn't have enough nurses or midwives. So ordinary shopkeepers were identified, trained, and provided pills and condoms in 100% of all the villages. So over that time, and including teachers to help promote it, we had a very, very lucky piece of progress, I guess. The number of children per family came down from 7 to 1.2, and the population growth rate in 1973-74 was 3.3%, and it's come down in about 23 years to 0.5. So those have been clearly achieved. And then when AIDS came along, we used similar principles, public education, saying prevention is the only cure. And we had public education everywhere, and the government asked us to join in, and I became a cabinet minister, and this was added through the government, you know, using an NGO system into the government. And after about 12 years, the UNAIDS said that there was a decline of 90% in new cases, and a World Bank report in 2005 said during those 12 years, the number of people that had been prevented from being infected was about 7.7 million. So those two work very, very clearly. So we're now on to other things, gender equality, democracy, and poverty alleviation. So those are the other things we're doing. And we also hope to provide more of what we have. We have what we call access to credit as a human right. Poor people are engaged in business, but they don't succeed. They lack business skills and they lack credit. And so we need to help them with business skills and access to credit. It must be a human right and allow them to use labor as collateral. So these are the things we're doing now and to get people out of poverty. But our activities with them, where there's some financial input, which come from companies, not from ourselves, come from companies, not from government, because they know business skills and they provide some resource. And that's been going on for about 20 years. We've refined it and it works very well. And within the 6 years, and then we asked the company not to provide any more financial resources, only advice. And it is totally sustainable because every dollar that is put in, 60 cents, is kept in a microcredit fund operated by the villagers. So that's sustainability for them. And it's very well to say sustainability for them. We have to also be sustainable. So we started in 1974, and 1 year after that, we started our first company. We classify them as business for social progress, where the profits can only be used for reserve, expansion, or given to charitable causes. And today, about 65% of PDA's financial needs are supplied by the companies, which were established as a separate legal entity from separate funds, but basically as friends of PDA and supplies financial resources to PDA. So that's sort of our history. We have about 1,000 people working, about 350 in a nonprofit, at about 650 in the business area.
Interesting. So your own background has been very checkered. You've had, you know, as a wealth of experience in numerous sectors, and you as you yourself mentioned, you were a senator, you were in the cabinet. Tell us a little bit about your own background and why you thought this was important.
Well, my mother's Scottish, my father's Thai. They met at Edinburgh University. They came back to Thailand after they married. I was sent to Australia for schooling at 13, and then went to university there and worked a little bit and came back, so 12 years in Australia. And the school I went to sort of valued people and things and standards rather than money. So I was brought up to say that, you know, honesty means you know whether you've been honest or not. You don't have to have people catch you out. And then when I came back, and again, my parents were strong about saying that, you know, there are people who need help. If people like us who've had a very good chance in life and having education, if we don't help them, who's going to help them? So I was never drawn to business. I was drawn to this, so I started in the government as an economist, and I went around the countryside reporting on the progress in the evaluation department. So that was my start, and after spending quite a lot of time up country, I noticed that there were children everywhere, number one. And the second one was that people were not invited to participate in activities. They were just called sort of recipients. So those two things were very, very clear. So I just followed my instinct to do this. And when the population issue was clearly defined, we said, well, we'll have to do something about it because the government didn't do enough. So we started off with the family planning and getting the distribution of oral contraceptives made available at the village level in every village. So everyone was within simple proximity of birth control pills and condoms.
How was that received? I know back in India too, where family planning is a important issue, there have obviously over the years been resistance and also just, you know, a lot of animosity against government. And then that's changed. But there's always this sort of push-pull between the people and the authorities who are trying to bring this in, or even non-profit organizations. How did the Thai people respond over time?
Well, our approach was very, very simple. You've got to respect the people you work with, you try to provide services for, and they must be part of the service provision. Don't expect them to be a target audience and then you give them or you do something for them. They have to be part of the rowing team. They have to help row the boat together. That's number one. And the other one is that when it comes to matters of family planning and so on, it's a very personal matter. So it's important they get to trust you first. So we got them to trust us, and we played with our children. We went to the school. We didn't talk about family planning first until they got to know us well. And then we started doing some family planning work without saying, my gosh, you've got 9 children. What a crazy life. We just say, my, you must be a very smart person to be able to take care of 9 children. And you know, my parents can only take care of 4. And we fell along. They said, well, you know, that's not what we really wanted to do. And we wanted less. And then we say, well, you know, there's a method now that can help you space the number of children, like your coconut trees or your rice plants and so on. And that's the way we move in. And then the local shopkeeper, who's very well known in the village and liked and respects the people, they became the agents of change and provided the pills and condoms. We also used the school teachers to help spread the message in the schools. We came up with a snakes and ladders game. We had a new alphabet where, you know, C for condom, B for birth, and all those things. And at the same time, we also had a new song, well, an old song, old music and new words, and every contraceptive method was in that song. So we had also a snakes and ladders game, where when kids land on a number that's negative to family planning, they come back with something positive, they move ahead. So those were the things we did, you know, through edutainment, and people were involved, kids were involved. We trained over 250,000 rural school teachers to help spread the message. So it became everybody's function, a job, responsibility. So it wasn't them and wasn't us. It was our effort together.
Yeah, and I think the humorous approach that you employed, I think I understand, it resonated with a Thai sense of humor, so people were able to deal with a more sensitive or personal topic, which I think was pretty clever.
And the humor came after they got to know you. You just can't start off with humor. They have to know you, trust you, and say, well, we'll work with you, and then you can add the humor. Because when people laugh with you, it's very difficult to be your opposition.
Mm-hmm. Are you worried sometimes that you're dealing with so many different areas in the work? It started with family planning and some of the more obvious mm-hmm. issues, and then you've sort of branched into so many clearly connected areas. But do you worry about being diffused, or do you see all of these as being critical and you're doing, you know, the right sort of balance?
We believe we're doing the right thing, and we want to do more. We've started our road of education, a whole new revolution in education, where the business community helps to supply funds to start a school and another sum of money to get a business going, so that in the long run, the business will support the school. We don't have to go and ask more money from the company. That's one area. And the other one, on the human rights issue, we've been doing quite a bit on the prevention of trafficking, rather than trying to catch all those people who are already in brothels. We have programs where we know why they've gone into commercial sex. They lack money. They lack education, so we supply that. And at the same time, we're going to be doing some work with the community. We have about 2 million from Myanmar in Thailand, and we want to work with them and give them the same opportunity, not because they're Thais or non-Thais, because they're humans. So we take an approach. We don't care about nationality. So we're also going to be looking for resources to work with the Burmese people and to get them to be independent business people, because poor people are, in fact, engaged in business. But they lack business skills and they lack credit. So these are things we want to do and get businesses also involved, because unless the business helps, then you're not going to get very far, because government officials don't know about business skills. So we're broadening it out, education, also democracy, governance. Those things all go together. It's not just one or the other. It's just like a government. You know, government has to do many things, and we have to do many things. Reason for it is because there is such a big void in what we call the market imperfections. We are needed, not just we, but a lot of NGOs, civil society organizations are needed because of the huge market imperfections.
Mm-hmm. How do you measure impact of your work? What are some ways in which you know you're succeeding?
It's over time. You change over time. For instance, how many people you get to join your effort, that's one. And then the others are, what have they achieved? Now, we measure the family planning very clearly by the birth rate that's come down and the number of children per family. You can't lie about that. That's true. On the HIV AIDS, too. Clear statistics with the UN is the new infections that have come down 90%. That wasn't done by us. That was done by the UN. And the other one by the World Bank, that almost 8 million people were prevented from being infected. Those results are there and clearly. And in terms of reducing poverty, we also have a very clear program. And we measure before we begin, and we take a look after 1 year, 2 years, 3 years. We also ask them to let us know in what we call the bamboo ladder. The lowest rung in the ladder is 1, and the highest is 10. We ask them, where are you in terms of your economic condition today? And we ask them, what was it 2 years ago? And then what do you think it'll be 2 years from now? So they tell us what things are today, what they were yesterday, and what they perceive to be for tomorrow. And we check every type of activities because we want to know. And we measure things. We ask people. Newspapers also go and ask them. And for instance, an example of in the Sinimi area, we worked in 60 villages, and definitely the income has gone up. It looks good. But the newspapers went and asked them, and they said that their lives today are better than before the tsunami days. Because the people will tell you whether it's worked or not.
So I'm going to push you a little bit more on this because you've clearly done so much in so many different sectors. How do you know, though, that it's your interventions that have helped versus, especially with social change, there could be so many other factors that play into it. So is it just that you're content knowing that change has occurred and you've sort of, you know, targeted it, or are you? How can you tell that?
Yeah, changes are occurring, and our end product is that, be it the quality of life or the issue of participation by the people, level of income, whatever it is. Now, obviously, we live in an open society. There may be a few other things involved, and I would say that, you know, in our success in family planning, the government also had something to help. Other people all had something. For instance, we do 30% of the country's vasectomy with very few clinics, and we do 80% of Bangkok's vasectomies as reported by the government. Now, why did they come to us? Because they trust us and so on. These are the things. And the fact that we have businesses and the businesses provide profits so that 65-70% of our financial needs are supplied by our own resources, I mean, you don't lie about that, that's real. And when you take a look at the impact of the people, use the same principle. In many of the villages, we also get them to help establish what we call business for social progress, whereby they keep half the profit and the other half goes towards helping the problem that they've identified. So all these things, and we are not living in isolation or in a vacuum. And of course, I'm sure there are a few other things that have helped. And that's fine, because we don't say that it's solely because of us. We say that the target audience that we work with, the group of people, have a better life. And we believe part of it was with us.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's the other metrics, reference point is that people, your clients or your partners keep coming back to you, whether it's businesses or government. So that in some ways is a different kind of measure of success.
And they are sustainable. The programs we begin in the villages after 6 years, it's totally financially sustainable. And we're the only ones doing it. So obviously that's our work, that's for sure.
What were some things you were able to do effectively as a government official when you were in the cabinet versus you feel, I understand you're not in the government now, you are now running this organization and sort of innovating at other levels. What have you been doing, you know, that sort of was easier to do from the outside?
In the government, you are much more constrained. That's the general principle. Probably the role that perhaps most people say that had the greatest effect was the issue of HIV/AIDS. That we took what PDA was doing, we took them to the government, and we expanded it by the government into other areas. So PDA's model, everything was used in the government, by the government. So that was one very, very clear area, and you can see the results. But at the same time, many of the things have worked, but also people can change after you leave. And I was a member of the cabinet, not as a politician or member of a party, but I was invited in, a bit like the cabinet in America. They invite certain people to come and sit, rather than getting them from the House of Representatives or from the Senate. So I'm not a professional politician. I went in there to put out some fires, as they requested. But I would say that anything that I can do outside lasts. Whereas in the government, it's somewhat temporary. But luckily, HIV/AIDS worked and lasted. But even with that, in the last few years, the government has somewhat fallen asleep at the wheel on public education. And they've come back to me again to sort of reignite it. So I've gone back from being a feather duster to becoming a sort of a part-time rooster.
You're clearly, your legacy sort of continues in this work, and you're constantly straddling, I think, the two, the business and the government sectors in very active ways, which is fantastic. What are some issues plaguing Thailand in the years ahead? What do you see sort of coming up that PDA will probably, you know, want to wrestle with?
Well, definitely, although it's not, the women have a pretty good time here, but I think that Thailand is losing out by not having women run at least 50% of everything in Thailand. It's not the women are losing out, it's citizens are losing out. So that I push very, very strongly on gender equality. In fact, I'd love to have it up to superiority. Because all our work in rural Thailand, the women have been outstanding. They've contributed. The men have too, but the women have been most impressive. So that's one issue. And the other one is a very slow democracy after 65 years. It doesn't work. We've had about 17 coups, and people buy votes, politicians buy votes. We have a lot of crooks running the country. And that is simply because we do not, or we have not had programs to teach kids about democracy from kindergarten upwards. You can't just let it occur and happen. It's going to be part of life, part of culture. So we want to do more of that. We're doing it in the villages. We call it village youth government. They're elected and they're trained to help run things. And many now, after 11 years, they've been invited to run in the election at the local government, and more are getting in there. And definitely philanthropy, we want to do a lot more. We're going to start teaching in the schools what we call the joy of doing public good. Poor kids as well, so that we want to build up a whole lot of philanthropists in Thailand, lots and lots and lots of mini Bill Gates and many, many, many Jeff Skoll, and also education. We want education to be better, to be a higher standard, and you know, with that, democracy will improve, gender equality improve, and a great deal of equality in society, which is somewhat suffering from a great imbalance because of a lot of rich, and not too many rich, but a lot of poor. And so we want to do and get philanthropy across to the rich as well as to everybody else, so that when kids grow up, they will have what I call individual social responsibility before they can show corporate social responsibility. So these are things that I do ahead, but obviously I can't succeed in all, but I'll try my best.
And your activities span several areas within Thailand. Now, do you also expect to go to other countries? Seems like there'll be at least a number of countries that could benefit from a similar model and approach.
We have a training center with PDA, our international arm, called the Asian Center for Population and Development. And in the last 21 years, we've been training people from about 27 countries, about approximately 2,000 people. And we said, this is what we do, and these are the principles. And if you want to succeed, you do the same thing using the principles, but make some variations according to your culture and traditions. But one very, very important thing that you must do like us, and that is work hard. Now, you can change things, but you've got to also work hard, otherwise you will never succeed. So, and we'll be doing more, and hopefully we'll be doing more with the Gates Foundation in other countries, and in terms of NGO sustainability, financial sustainability, in terms of philanthropy and I hope to also begin to start up very, very soon, is the Social Stock Exchange.
Oh, tell us about that.
Well, a stock exchange, Social Stock Exchange is an exchange. It doesn't have to be formal, but it can be official, where companies make their shares available, and people buy shares because the company is doing interesting work, but more importantly, it gives its profits, a large proportion of its profits, to very, very exciting social activities. And we're doing this ourselves, but nobody else can buy into our shares, or have not yet. So we want to make this open to other people to come in, and the accounting will be on the web. So everyone will know where our resources come in, what our expenditures are in every detail. And then we hope, we're not sure whether it's to be a third of the profits go back to them or half. We're having a seminar tomorrow with Asian Development Bank and some people from England and Brazil and one of the universities to take this further in Thailand. So we want to establish that, because basically then you will have a business arm or business arms that will do good business but generate part of their profits towards changing society. In Thai, we used to call it business for social progress, but we want more and more people to buy into it, because a lot of people don't want to give their money away because it's gone. But by doing it this way, it grows.
Very interesting, and I'd be eager to see how that shapes up in the next some time.
Yes, we all look forward to it.
Yes. So again, thank you so much. This has been very interesting, and Thailand is not an area that the West or much of the rest of the world focuses on as much. Mm-hmm. So it's wonderful that we had a chance to talk with you and also to learn firsthand so many of the successes that you've managed to achieve in this short duration. Big change statistically when you mention some of the impacts by way of reduction in population and AIDS, HIV awareness campaign, so on. Just a tremendous impact. So thank you so much.
Thank you very much indeed, Sheila. Okay, thank you.
This is your host, Sheila Sethuraman, and you were listening to Design for Change.
You've been listening to an interview by Sheila Sethuraman in the Design for Change series.
Sheila Sethuraman is a correspondent of the Center for Social Innovation, a department of the Stanford Graduate School of Business that educates leaders to solve the world's toughest social and environmental issues. She asked accomplished social entrepreneurs how they design and run their organizations for impact.
The post-production audio engineer for this program was Andy Dolph. Our website editor was Kevin Shockey. The series producer is Kevin Shockey.
This is Chris Deigelmeyer
and Eric Nee on Social Innovation Conversations.
Thank you for listening.